welcome to, where are we? This is, I believe, August 10th, Tuesday's edition of Financial Advisor, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody has the program off today. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. First, a big shout out to our consummate producer and engineer, Todd. I had loads of trouble getting on to the program today. So thank you, Todd. You are the man. Let's get started with today's market report. Gold, fairly flat day, trading within a modest range. It's the New York spot after market. It's down about 80 cents, at just shy of $1,730 an ounce. Silver down 11 cents at 23.42. Platinum up, on the other hand, up $18 at $1,003 an ounce. And palladium up $40 at $27.27. Now, let's see. Let's go jump to oil. Domestic oil up $1.99 a barrel today, almost 3%, closing at $68.47 a barrel. International Brent up about $1.72 at $70.76. Treasury market, in terms of yields, had a positive day, although from an investing standpoint, the par values were down. The bellwether 10-year yield up 0.3 basis points to close at 1.347%. 5-year up 32/100ths at 0.824%. 30-year closed up slightly at just below 2% at 1.99. The dollar index, U.S. dollar index, again up 0.14 to close at 93.08. And in the all-hyped paper markets, we've got the Dow Jones up 162 and change to close at 35,265 on a rounded basis. The broader S&P 500 up 4.4, close at 4,437, rounded. And the NASDAQ actually down 72 points to close at 14,788. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's DGS Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, if you have cable TV, some of our listeners do, maybe you tuned in to your favorite cable news channel, or even tuned in to the Senate chambers, where late this morning the Senate passed a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure plan. It's being hailed as a victory for the country, but for the time being, a huge step for Democrats as they try to push President Joe Biden's sweeping economic agenda through the Congress. The legislation, which includes $550 billion in new funding for transportation, broadband, and utilities, got through in a 69-30 vote, with 19 Republicans joining all 50 Democrats. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer immediately turned to a budget resolution that would allow Democrats to debate and approve, well, not just them, but would allow senators to debate and approve what they see as a complementary $3.5 trillion spending plan without any Republican votes. House Speaker Pelosi has been saying for a month now that she won't take up the infrastructure bill or Democrats' separate proposal to expand the social safety net in this reconciliation package until the Senate passes both of them. I'm not sure how that political calculus works for them. The House, in any event, doesn't return from its recess until September 20th, so it could take several more months for Congress to pass both measures. The bill, the bill's approval in the Senate, for now, caps a months-long effort for the White House and both parties in Congress to forge a plan to upgrade American roads and railways, public transit, water systems, power grids, and cable broadband for rural America. Congress for years failed to agree in a comprehensive infrastructure package, which supporters in both parties now say will boost the economy and create jobs. Rob Portman of Ohio and the bill's lead GOP negotiator said, after years or even decades of talking about the need to do this, we're finally getting it done. Of course, Democrats pushed to pass their full-scale economic agenda could still fall apart. The infrastructure bill passed by the Senate does appear to have enough support, bipartisan, to coast through the House. But to win over both centrists, who are wary of a $3.5 trillion price tag, and progressives, who want more spending on child care, paid leave, and climate policy, Pelosi has said, again, she won't pass one bill without the other. Now, in order to approve their plan through budget reconciliation without Republicans, Democrats cannot lose a single member of their 50-person Senate caucus, or more than a handful of House members. Schumer expects to start the so-called Votorama, where the Senate considers an indefinite number of amendments to the budget resolution, and it started right away. It started today. They were on a fourth amendment when I finally turned it off. The chamber plans to start its own recess, the Senate that is, once it passes the budget measure, and it too is expected to return in mid-September. Schumer's given Senate committees a September 15th target to finish writing their portions of the final budget legislation. The bill would then have to work its way through both chambers of Congress. Now, centrists, Democratic centrists like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Kristen Sinema of Arizona, have signaled that they will vote for the budget resolution, but they will try to trim the $3.5 trillion price tag. Republicans have started to hammer the Dems for the proposed spending, and some of the individual tax increases on the wealthy they hope to use to offset its cost. Biden and the Democrats want a signature policy that they can promote on the midterm campaign trail next year as they try to hold on to both chambers of Congress. Their plan is to extend child tax credits, health care subsidies passed during the pandemic, lower the Medicare eligibility age to as low as 60, and expand benefits and use tax credits, rebates, and polluter fees to encourage the adoption of their green energy goals. So the bipartisan bill was the first step. Puts $110 billion into roads, bridges, and other major projects, $66 billion into passenger and freight rail, $65 billion into broadband, primarily for rural areas, $55 billion into water systems, and $39 billion into public transit. Although I heard just a little while ago that none of that $39 billion includes anything for high-speed rail like we see in other countries. Now, funding for the bipartisan bill will come from unused pandemic relief money, unused federal unemployment insurance aid, and other sources. Republicans resisted Biden's proposal to hike the corporate tax rate to offset some of the costs. While senators, Dems have said, and the bipartisan group have said the bill will be paid for, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates it will increase budget deficits by about $250 billion over the next 10 years. So a big day in Washington, where at least by lunchtime, togetherness was the rule, if not kumbaya, but it will quickly devolve back into partisan fighting. Now, interestingly, cryptocurrencies may sell themselves as a non-government currency, yet they're discovering that ignoring authorities doesn't mean authorities will ignore you. The Senate infrastructure bill passed this morning includes a crypto tax reporting rule that includes language for broad oversight of virtual currencies. And despite an intense lobbying campaign that made the crypto industry look like, you know, the regulars, the K Street regulars, the banks, the oil companies, and the like, agreement on an amendment to remove this broad language wasn't reached. Setback has done little to dim the popularity of cryptos, with Bitcoin trading near 46K this morning. That was more than a 50% gain for just the last 3 weeks. Lawmakers have been in different camps about how broadly or narrowly to define the term broker in the infrastructure bill, and arguing essentially about which companies exactly would be subject to new crypto tax reporting rules. The definition decides who has to report cryptocurrency gains to the IRS under the new regulations, and the gains threshold where the requirements kick in. The tax proceeds from this particular provision are expected to fund up to $28 billion in infrastructure investment. Now, Senators Warner, Portman, and Sinema, bipartisan group, wanted to include software developers and so-called validators like miners and stakers in the definition. Senators Toomey, Loomis, and Wyden's narrower proposal excluded various crypto-related companies and organization. The compromise text, which was supported by Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen, excludes software developers and validators. Now, after these amendments to narrow the definition failed to pass, crypto advocates reacted strongly, already having raised fears that a wide scope could hurt their industry and hinder it from developing. I suspect that might be the goal of some of those who opposed narrowing the language. Now, lobbyists now are urging senators to reintroduce the compromise amendment through the budget reconciliation process. I'm sure that will come. In the meantime, the original broader definition of a crypto broker is headed for the federal code books. That's probably a good thing. I'm not saying here, you know, whether, you know, investing in crypto is a good or bad thing. If you know enough about it and have the spare change, well, then good for you. Go for it. But it does bring to mind a recent post by Steve Randy Waldman about why crypto's a transitional technology that ultimately needs at least some regulation. It's probably not the ethos of Satoshi, but it's one way forward for an industry that's boomed to a scale impossible for governments to ignore. Satoshi Nakamoto is known as the father of crypto. Satoshi is also the smallest unit of Bitcoin currently recorded on the blockchain, representing 100 millionth of a Bitcoin. Now, worker productivity. Its growth slowed in the second quarter, and labor costs were far weaker than previously estimated in the quarter before, according to a new Labor Department report out this morning. Non-farm productivity, which measures hourly output per worker, increased at a 2.3% annualized rate in the second quarter. Data for the first quarter was revised lower to show productivity rising at a 4.3% rate instead of the previously reported 5.4%. Economists had expected productivity to rise at a 3.5% rate. It's more than 50% more than the actual. Anyway, productivity jumped early in the pandemic, you may recall, before slumping in the final quarter of 2020, but has since rebounded. The seesawing has been partly attributed to the cratering of lower wage industries like leisure and hospitality, which have been reopening over the past few months at an increasingly fast pace. Compared to the second quarter of 2020, productivity rose at 1.9%. Total hours worked, however, increased at a 5.5% rate last quarter. That's up from a revised 4% growth pace in the first quarter. Overall now, output is now 1.2% above pre-pandemic levels, but total hours worked remain 2.8% below it. The resurgence in economic activity just has not been matched by people flooding back into the workforce, even though there's still a big gap. Yesterday, the Labor Department reported that U.S. job openings jumped to a fresh record high in June. Small business owners across the country have grown less confident in the recovery in July as labor shortages remain a big issue. Now, despite the cooling in the most recent data, Oxford economist Lydia Bozour said the pandemic appears to have induced an upside shock to productivity. The adoption of technologies accelerated, she added, and new firms are being created at a historic pace. Plus, the shift to remote work is likely to outlast the crisis. Unit labor cost, which is the price of labor per single unit of output, rose at a 1% rate. It actually contracted at a revised 2.8% pace in the first quarter. Hey, we're already out of time for this first segment. We're going to head into a short break. Please stay tuned to these few important messages, and we will return. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, thank you, Beth Ann, for that uplifting message. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody today, who's taking care of other business. We're talking about jobs and productivity. Really demanding our attention with all the headlines related to, well, to the new wrench in, you know, a lot of economic business reopenings and economic growth with this actual scary recurrence of this variant. But in any event, let's continue along that stream for just a little longer. Talk about demand for labor, which seems to be getting stronger and stronger, while workers are taking advantage of that by simply quitting their job. I mean, while businesses are scrambling to fill job openings as they try to catch up with, you know, all the booming consumer demand, they're also aggressively raising wages to recruit. It's often now resulting in workers quitting their older jobs for better opportunities. Almost 4 billion workers quit their jobs in June, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics JOLTS survey, Job Openings and Labor Turnover survey. This is close to the record set in April of I guess 10,000 more, it looks like. This represents 2.7% of the workforce in June, which is also just below April's record, 2.8%. Quits as a percentage of total separations, which includes layoffs, firings, and retirements, reached 69.3% in June. This metric, also known as the Take This Job and Shove It indicator, is at an all-time high. According to DataTrek co-founder Jessica Rabe, people tend to leave their jobs when they find a better opportunity. And we think part of the high quits rate reflects the massive suburbanization trend that started during the pandemic. That's an interesting theory, I'm going to call it. We'll have to follow that trend and see where it takes us 6 months down the line. Now, many of these folks are accounted for in the 6.7 million hirings that occurred during June, but the fact that job openings still set a new record of 10 million during the same period speaks to how strong the demand for labor continues to be. For context, there were 9.5 million unemployed workers during the period. In other words, there were more job openings than unemployed workers. A dynamic that hasn't occurred since before the pandemic. All right. I know it's been, 25 minutes, and we haven't, I don't believe we've mentioned this word yet, but more Federal Reserve officials say that last Friday's job report supports the case for tapering. That is, tapering these supportive monetary policies, particularly the QE, the $120 billion a month bond buying the Fed's been doing since last March. These Fed officials say that with the economy progressing, I'll tell that to the millions still unemployed, everyone wants to know when the Fed will taper its quantitative easing program and eventually start hiking interest rates. And we talked a lot about this last week. I wrote about it. Yesterday, Atlanta Fed President Raphael Bostic said the jobs report was definitely quite encouraging. He said he thinks the Fed could begin tapering QE sometime in the fourth quarter range, but added he would be open to moving it forward, depending on the strength of upcoming jobs data. At another event, Richmond Fed President Thomas Barkin said there was still more room to run in the labor market. But Barkin, as well as Bostic, believes that inflation is at a level that meets the requirement for tapering. Bostic and Barkin, most notably, are both voting members of the Fed's Open Market Committee, Policy Setting Committee. Meanwhile, Boston Fed President Eric Rosengarten, who's not a voting member, said that the economic data already support the Fed's announcing in September that it would start tapering QE sometime this fall. The August jobs report will be released on September 3rd. Another robust report, they say, could tilt more Fed members toward announcing the taper sooner. Whether it's September, October, November, or a little later, most so-called experts seem to agree that the trajectory of the economy supports tapering, at least the tapering announcement, in the next few months. My own humble opinion, again, as I wrote about last week, I don't think they get it. As long as QE keeps supporting the stock market as a proxy for the overall economy, I think it's going to be later, not sooner, that tapering starts. But we shall see. Now, credit card transaction data. They suggest the recent surge in infections is starting to impact parts of the economy. They tell us the economy has been on an upward, if not a roller coaster type trajectory, generating almost a million jobs in July alone. The big unknown is how much the spread of the Delta variant could derail that rebound, recovery, whatever you want to call it. Looking at too big to fail J.P. Morgan debit and credit card transactions, economist Jesse Edgerton observed that spending in travel and entertainment softened in July as the infection started to accelerate. Most notably, he said, airline spending has fallen almost 20% from a recent peak, that coming in mid-July, a larger decline than during the severe winter COVID wave when spending was at much lower levels. It's not alone. Bank of America saw a similar pattern in its own debit credit card data. The slowing in air travel is not just a story for this week, the bank said. The two-year growth rate of air travel peaked 4 weeks ago and has taken a turn lower. Potentially, it added, reflecting the risks from the Delta variant. This is just one category of spending. In fact, the BOA credit card spending levels for the week ending July 31st were 10% above pre-pandemic levels. But the details of July's retail sales bear close watching when they're released next Tuesday, because we'll get further clues about what categories are getting hit as this rise of infection continues in the headlines. Now, I don't know if you heard this, and I forgive me if Melody and Butch talked about this yesterday, but last Friday, the U.S. Postal Service finalized a plan to slow down some of the first-class mail delivery starting October 1st as part of efforts to, yes, cut red ink. The plan proposed by Postmaster General Louis DeJoy in March, surprise, he's still there, will revise the existing 1 to 3 day service standards to 1 to 5 days. The UPS said that 61% of first class mail would remain at the current standard. The agency added that the additional 1 or 2 days to current service standards for first class mail and periodicals will enable the Postal Service to convey a greater volume of mail by surface transportation. DeJoy said some of the changes may be uncomfortable for some, but assures that is committed to delivering to every address in the nation 6 days a week and strives for financial sustainability. Now, Congress is considering a plan to provide the Postal Service with $46 billion in financial relief over 10 years, including the elimination of its requirement that the Postal Service pre-fund retiree health benefits for 75 years. That would be a huge relief in terms of financial stress for the organization, although let's hope that the pension plan stays at least adequately funding for those retirees who've contributed to it and are due to receive their benefits over the coming years. Auto part prices will continue to rise into the end of the year as cost pressures showed no sign of abating. That's according to industry executives. Higher costs for products, shipping containers, and labor. Once again, we're hearing a lot about that trio, will result in auto part prices rising by another 5% by year end. That's according to car parts CBO Lev Peeker. Prices have already increased 5 to 7% this year. Peeker noted, everything is backordered right now. Everything takes weeks or months. It's a very tight supply chain. And he added that the whole process of moving products through that chain takes 2 months longer now than before the pandemic. The industry, like many others, has grappled with the shortage of containers and cargo ships, which of course has expanded shipping times. And once ships arrive at port, they face another delay due to slow unloading times caused by, yes, a labor shortage. And then a shortage of delivery truck drivers adds to the wait times. Melody talked last week about companies recruiting drivers from Europe to make up that shortage because they're able to get their commercial driver's license at a younger age than they are here. I think you have to be 21 in the U.S. In any event, that's resulting in higher prices, most of them being passed on to the consumer. Now, before the extension of the federal government's moratorium on evictions, more than 11 million Americans were reported being behind on their rent. How much renters owe varies greatly from one state and county to the next. That's according to Sergo Ventures. It's a nonprofit organization that focuses on health and data in general. Across the country, the average renter household in arrears owes $3,700. The typical debt in Alabama is $2,700. In California, meanwhile, it's closer to $5,300. In some areas, renters face even larger debt. In San Mateo County, California, I believe that's north of San Francisco, typical renters behind $8,700. And struggling renters in Bergen County, New Jersey, suburban New York City, owe an average of $6,400. A study earlier this year by New York University found that thousands of renters in Manhattan and the other boroughs have debts, rental debts, over 10,000. Sergo's Aaron Dibner Dunlap said, if you live in a county with a high cost of living, such as many in California and New York, officials need to ensure there are enough public funds to cover the estimated debt. Now, the share of renters who are behind, about 16% of all of them, hasn't changed much since March. That's in large part because of how slow states and cities have been in distributing $46 billion in federal rental assistance previously allocated by Congress. By the end of June, just $3 billion of the $46 had reached people. In any event, renters now have a little more time to try to access that government aid before they again have to fear being evicted. The new CDC extension lasts until October 3rd. In places where COVID rates remain high, that currently covers about 80% of counties across the country. Now, here's sort of a disturbing story, sort of like akin to Congress raiding the Social Security Medicare trust funds. It looks like members of Congress from both parties are trying to turn the massive federal employee pension fund into a tool for political ends, using its huge financial sway to support or oppose certain industries. We saw this somewhat at the public level, a lot more at the private pension fund level, with apartheid in South Africa back in the day. The $500 billion thrift savings plan is the largest defined contribution retirement plan in the world. But those charged with overseeing it say politicizing any of its investment decisions risks its overall financial health. Democrats want to use it to go after, predictably, fossil fuel companies. Republicans, predictably, too, want to bar Chinese-owned firms from getting any of the money. The Democratic chair of the Senate committee that oversees the fund, and which will consider President Biden's new nominees to the board running it, feels any effort to use the plan to advance policy goals is misguided. Well, last week, Biden nominated four new members of the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, which oversees the thrift savings plan. Progressives are pushing for Biden's nominees to divest the fund's assets from fossil fuel companies. Revolving Door Project, a good government group, called on one of the nominees to rise to the occasion and lead that effort. Senators Jeff Merkley and Maggie Hassan requested a study this year on the feasibility of that fossil fuel divestment. Hassan's a member of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, which will consider Biden's new nominees. Senate Homeland Security Chair Gary Peters is cool on investment decisions that aren't financially rooted. One of his committee aides said Senator Peters does not think that federal employees' retirement funds should be used as a political football. But it's not just the Dems trying to leverage the fund. Senator Tommy Tuberville, Alabama, introduced legislation that would codify a Trump administration policy temporarily blocking the fund from investing in Chinese-owned companies. A similar bipartisan version of that legislation was introduced during the last Congress. All right, I hear some more music. That means time to take a deep breath. You can sit back, take a short break. Please rejoin us after we come back. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188 or online at DGScoins.com. DGScoins.com. Our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. This week's edition has another methodical analysis called Ebb and Flow from Doug Nolan, founder of the Credit Bubble Bulletin blog, plus a foreboding essay about trust, of all things, by Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. You can sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs at dgscoins.com. Please do so. Fridays, What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog criticized Wall Street's and corporate media's predictable, but I think premature, giddy optimism over the latest government jobs report. The Department of Labor's July numbers were strong, to be sure, with payrolls jumping and the grossly misleading undercounted official, emphasis on official, unemployment rate falling more than expected. As the president noted in his message, there's still a lot of progress to be made in the labor market, and the recent spike in COVID cases tells me, anyway, it's far too early to celebrate. The national economy continues to show strong, if inconsistent, momentum, which is putting more pressure on the Fed, as we mentioned earlier today, to start tapering its $120 billion monthly bond purchases earlier than initially expected. However, the consensus among economists is that cutting back too early risks having the economy backslide. And by economy, many, especially Fed officials, mean the stock market, whose growth since the Great Recession has benefited the wallets of the 1% at an extraordinary rate compared to the rest of us peons. On the other hand, economist Leslie Preston at TD Bank believes if the pace of hiring over the last 3 months continues, all jobs lost to the pandemic will be regained in 7 months. On the other hand, Minneapolis Fed Pres Neil Kashkari warns if Delta causes the labor market to heal much more slowly, that that's going to cause me to think about continuing bond buys to help speed the return of jobs. Well, again, employers added 943 jobs in July, which was considerably better than the 850,000 economists had been expecting. The labor market, again, is still 7 to 9 million jobs shy of what could have been expected by this time had that drastic, pandemic not blew up our lives. Yes, labor force participation climbed ever so slightly to 61.7% in July from 61.6 in June. Yet, it's still well below the February 2020 level of 63.3% and well further below its 20-year high of 66.8% in 2001. Now, the civilian labor force participation rate, let's call it CLP for short, represents the number of people in the labor force as a percentage of the civilian non-institutional population. In other words, the participation rate is the percentage of the population that's either working or actively looking for work, thus labor force divided by civilian non-institutional population times 100 is the participation rate. The civilian non-institutional population comprises Americans who are age 16 and older, excluding active duty members of the military, and people confined to or living in institutions or facilities like jails and skilled nursing homes. The BLS says the CLP rate's an important labor market measure because it represents the relative amount of labor resources available for the production of goods and services. Though subject to some cyclical influence, the CLP is primarily affected by longer-term structural changes. These might include changes in the age demographics of the population, school enrollment, educational attainment, employer-provided pensions, and, of course, Social Security benefits. After rising for over three decades, the overall labor force participation rate peaked in early 2000 and has trended downward ever since. More recently, the movement of the baby boom population into age groups that generally show low labor force participation has contributed to the decline in the overall participation rate. From 2000 to 2015, for example, most of the major demographic groups saw a decrease in labor force participation. Teenagers experienced the largest drop in participation, which coincided with a rise in their school enrollment rate. Young adults aged 20 to 24 also showed a decline in participation, but the decrease wasn't as steep as that for teenagers. Women aged 25 to 54 also fell, with the decrease more distinct for women who didn't attend college. The labor force participation rate of men 25 to 54 continued its long-term decline. As in the past, that decrease in participation among men with less education was greater than that of men with more. However, labor force participation rates of men and women 55 and older rose from 2000 to 2009 and subsequently leveled off. And so, the pandemic parties on. Anu Gagar, the global investment strategist for Commonwealth Financial Network, says the pandemic effects are still at play. Points to the Census Bureau Household Pulse Survey, where that shows 2.8 million Americans said they're not working because they're concerned about getting or spreading the virus. And Sam Rowe of Axios notes that these folks would boost the participation rate by a full percentage point if they reentered the workforce. Economist Justin Wolfers cautioned that the July jobs report is based on a survey that reflects decisions made before the recent surge in COVID cases. And Oxford Economics chief financial economist Kathy Bostjancic says the highly contagious Delta variant casts a shadow on the labor market recovery in the coming months, threatening to slow the return of workers still on the sideline. Yes. The July jobs report clearly shows that the economy as a whole is on a promising trajectory. But, as Mike Allen observes, it remains to be seen exactly how the new wave is going to affect economic activity. Thus, it's critical to monitor future jobs reports closely for any signs of a slowdown or reversal in the labor market. This will be critical for the Fed and investors, although I wrote in Friday's blog, it, meaning tapering, is not going to happen anytime soon as long as the Fed sees its massive QE continuing to prop up the stock market as a proxy, misplaced as it is, for the economy. And that's despite last month's, this month's, or next month's jobs report. How it appears to be. More importantly, serious job hunters, even the discouraged and marginally attached, will be watching closely. In the meantime, I say beware the Ides of August. It's that non-farm jobs report that we'll be anticipating most over the next few weeks. All right, well, end today's program with this report. On July 21st, 2010, 11 years ago, on the heels of the greatest economic downturn since the Great Depression, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, Dodd-Frank for short, became the law of the land. Supporters promised Americans that, well, the law would reform the corrupt practices on Wall Street that had led to the largest taxpayer bailout of Wall Street in history. But, as Pam and Russ Martins write in this week's Wall Street on Parade, here we go again. 11 years later, every one of those corrupt practices are in full display at the too-big-to-fail mega banks. Losses from wild derivative bets, check. Proprietary trading for the house, check. Secret bailouts from the Fed, check. Credit default swaps, check. Continuation of private justice on Wall Street, check. Banks paying the rating agencies for their bond ratings, check. Banks giving insanely leveraged loans to hedge funds, check. Martin say if we want to find the poster child for every failed financial reform promise, we need look no further than J.P. Morgan Chase, the largest federally insured bank in the U.S., as well as officially the riskiest. The bank notably has also racked up 5 felony charges from the U.S. Department of Justice since Dodd-Frank was signed into law. Counts the bank has all agreed to. In 2013, only 3 years after Dodd-Frank became law, the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations released a 300-page report. It described how J.P. Morgan Chase had allowed traders in its London office to use bank depositors' funds from its federally insured U.S. bank to gamble in exotic derivatives and lose a mere $6.2 billion. Proving just how weak and ineffective Dodd-Frank was at reining in the cowboy casino on Wall Street, the woman who was in charge of supervising J.P. Morgan's traders in London, Ina Drew, didn't even have a trading license. Equally outrageous, even though the legislative intent of Congress in Dodd-Frank was clearly to prevent federally insured banks from owning hedge funds, well, J.P. Morgan Chase has skirted that mandate for the past 11 years with no pushback from its regulators. Throughout that period and to this day, J.P. Morgan Chase has owned the hedge fund Highbridge Capital Management, adding an element of revulsion, according the Martin's words. The purchase of the hedge fund by J.P. Morgan was brokered with the assistance of guess who? Deceased sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein, at least according to the New York Times. To attempt to appease progressives in 2010 who were demanding the restoration of the Glass-Steagall Act, which would have legally separated federally insured commercial banks from the trading casino investment banks, Section 619 was placed in Dodd-Frank instead. What's Section 619, you ask? Well, it's otherwise known as the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule, named after former Fed Chair Paul Volcker. It promised this. Unless otherwise provided in this section, a banking entity shall not A, engage in proprietary trading, or B, acquire or retain any equity, partnership, or other ownership interest in or sponsor a hedge fund or a private equity fund, unquote. Well, the public rightly took that language to mean that going forward, federally insured banks like J.P. Morgan Chase wouldn't be allowed to trade for the house and blow themselves up as they did in 2008, nor would they be allowed to own hedge funds and blow themselves up as they did in 2008. But Wall Street's lobbyists succeeded in stalling the implementation of the Volcker Rule. The rule wasn't even released by federal regulators until June last year. Yes, you heard me correctly. 10 years after the law's passage. The final rule contained so many exceptions, in fact, it was just one more on a heaping pile of jaded and broken promises by Congress to reform Wall Street and its too-big-to-fail banks. According to a March 2021 report that Highbridge Capital filed with the SEC. It's 100% owned by JP Morgan Chase. It has $6.4 billion in assets under management subject to regulation. Placing short bets to drive companies into the ground in the midst of a national health emergency appears to be one of the discretionary trading tactics used by Highbridge. According to HedgeWeek, Highbridge is one of the hedge funds that are continuing to pile short bets against Cineworld, with the beleaguered global movie theater chain, whose share price tumbled again this week, now the most shorted UK-listed stock. Cineworld's share price, in fact, has fallen by 50% since March. Bloomberg News reported last December that Highbridge was planning to raise as much as $2 to $3 billion, including borrowing, for a new strategy of equally dubious value during a pandemic, particularly that is investing in SPACs and PIPEs, or private investments in public equity. PIPEs, a newer type of equity that's used to support a merger with the target company once a deal has been agreed to. As the Martins conclude, it's long past time to clean up this toxic mess that threatens the financial stability of the U.S. yet once again, and thus the national security of the nation. Gary Gensler, are you listening? Janet Yellen, are you listening? Joe Biden, are you listening? Well, I want to thank you for listening to today's program. That's all the time we have for today. I'll be back on Thursday. Butch, join Melody tomorrow along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for tuning in to Financial Survival. Please, please be safe out there. Bye-bye. In my dreams, I have a plan. If I got